Welcome to 88 Diagnoses. All right, let's unpack this. Imagine you're on a busy service, and maybe a routine admission reveals a kid's sibling just got sent home from daycare with a tummy bug. Or maybe more jarring. A 28-year-old comes in, seems like typical gastro, right? And then hours later, boom, they crash into septic shock.
Yeah, it happens.
It's just such a striking reminder that while, yes, diarrheal disease is a huge killer worldwide, even here in resource-abundant settings, it's not always just, well, a nuisance.
Definitely not.
And for you, our dedicated medical residents on the wards, it throws up these critical, sometimes really high-stakes diagnostic challenges, management challenges too.
Every day.
So today, in this deep dive into acute diarrhea in adults, our mission, really, is to simplify two crucial decision points. These can feel like walking a tightrope sometimes.
I really can't.
First, when do you actually pull the trigger on stool testing? And second, whether to jump in with empiric antimicrobial therapy.
Key decisions.
We want to give you kind of a shortcut to confidence here.
Right.
Arm you with the knowledge to make those informed choices quickly, effectively, even when things are moving fast. Yeah. So let's get into it.
Okay. Let's start with the basics, though they're crucial. We all sort of know what diarrhea is, right? But on the wards, it's the details, the subtle distinctions that really guide your next steps.
Right.
So for our purposes, we define it as passing loose or watery stools. Typically, at least three times in a 24-hour period.
Okay.
And it reflects increased water content in the stool. That's either because water absorption is impaired or there's active secretion happening.
Makes sense.
But what really matters for your clinical approach is the duration. Acute, which is our focus today, means symptoms lasting 14 days or fewer.
Got it. 2 weeks.
Exactly. If it stretches beyond that, but it's still under 30 days, we call it persistent.
Okay.
And anything over 30 days, that's chronic, different ballgame.
And here's where I think it gets particularly interesting for, you know, for you on the front lines. Distinguishing between just simple, watery diarrhea and what we call invasive diarrhea or dysentery.
Yes, absolutely. Critical distinction.
That's diarrhea with visible blood or mucus, right? And crucially, it often comes with fever, abdominal pain.
Right.
This is a major clinical sign. It should immediately kind of change your thinking. It's that fork in the road.
Absolutely. That's a key pivot point. Now, the vast majority of acute diarrhea cases, especially in adults and, you know, resource-rich settings like ours, are infectious and self-limited.
Right. Most people just get better on their own.
Exactly. The usual suspects are viruses. Think norovirus, rotavirus, adenoviruses, astrovirus. They're so common, in fact, that stool cultures only actually find a bacterial cause in a really small percentage of overall cases. We're talking maybe 1.5% to 5.6%.
Wow, that low.
Yeah. Which is why, for many patients, we actually never pinpoint the exact bug causing it. However, and this is a big however, when we look specifically at severe diarrhea, the picture flips quite dramatically.
Okay.
Bacterial causes become much, much more prominent then. Now we're talking Salmonella, Campylobacter, Shigella, enteropoxygenic E. coli, and of course, C. diff, Clostridioides difficile.
The usual bacterial culprits.
Precisely. And one study looking just at severe cases found a bacterial pathogen in, get this, 87% of patients.
87%? That's huge. Like,
it really highlights the different severity makes. Protozoa like Cryptosporidium, Giardia, Cyclospora, Entamoeba, they're less common in acute presentations, but definitely something to keep on your radar for specific exposures or persistent cases.
And just to sort of put a public health impact out there, the U.S. Foodborne Diseases Active Surveillance Network, FoodNet, they reported over 25,000 cases of foodborne infection back in 2022.
Yeah, significant numbers.
Which led to almost 6,000 hospitalizations and 170 deaths. So while we might think of it as a nuisance for one person, the societal burden is definitely real.
No question.
You know, it's easy when you're slammed with other patients maybe on call to just dismiss a run-of-the-mill case.
Sure.
And that urge to test everything can be strong. But sometimes, honestly, your most powerful tool is just the history.
Absolutely. History is key.
So here's a practical approach for your shifts, an on-the-words tip. Mm. Always ask about food history, yes, but also the timing of symptom onset after they think they ate something bad.
Crucial timing.
If it's super fast, like within 6 hours, think preformed toxins, Staph aureus, Bacillus cereus.
Right. Quick onset.
If it's more like 8 to 16 hours, maybe Clostridium perfringens.
Okay.
But if it's longer, more than 16 hours, that points more towards a viral infection or maybe one of the other bacterial infections that need time to multiply.
That timing clue can be incredibly helpful up front.
It really can give you a powerful diagnostic hint before you even think about ordering a test.
Okay, so if you can't remember everything from this first part, remember this. Acute diarrhea is usually viral and self-limited. But the presence of blood or mucus, especially if there's fever that's invasive diarrhea or dysentery, that's a crucial red flag. It signals potentially severe bacterial causes that demand your attention.
Okay, let's move on to the art of evaluation. Mm-hmm. When do you really need to, you know, dig deeper? And maybe what's the one red flag you absolutely cannot ignore?
That's a great question because, like we said, most adults with acute diarrhea, they never even see a doctor. Symptoms are mild. They pass quickly.
Right.
But clinical evaluation is definitely warranted when you see those red flags. We're talking persistent fever, any bloody diarrhea, that's a big one, severe abdominal pain, clear symptoms of volume depletion.
Like what specifically?
Like dark or really scant urine, feeling dizzy when they stand up orthostasis, or if they have a history of inflammatory bowel disease, IBD. Those are the immediate stop and think signs.
Mm-hmm.
And hospitalization. Well, that becomes a real consideration with these concerns, especially if your patient has a complex medical history. Things like immunosuppression, maybe a transplant history, advanced HIV, or significant heart disease.
Okay, makes sense. So when you're taking that initial history, you really need to drill down beyond just how long and how often.
Mm.
What are the stools really like?
Exactly. The care.
Was there a fever? How bad is the pain? And fundamentally, are there signs of volume depletion? That's like your first line of defense in figuring out severity.
It is. And the character of the symptoms gives you huge clues about where the problem might be.
Small bowel versus large bowel?
Precisely. If it seems like small bowel origin, it's typically watery, large volume.
Mm.
Patients complain of cramping, bloating, gas. You'll rarely see a significant fever or occult blood.
Okay.
Contrast that with large intestinal origin. That often presents with frequent, small volume, often painful bowel movements. Fever and bloody or mucoid stools, much more common.
Oh.
These inflammatory signs, the fever, the blood, the mucus, they suggest invasive bacteria. Like Salmonella, Shigella, Campylobacter, or certain viruses like CMV or adenovirus, or Entamoeba histolytica, or even a cytotoxic bug like C. difficile.
And it feels critical to highlight again, visibly bloody acute diarrhea is actually relatively uncommon overall.
It is.
So when you see it, it immediately has to raise the possibility of Shiga toxin-producing E. coli stec.
Yes. Stec is a major concern with bloody diarrhea because of the HUS risk. Hemolytic uremic syndrome.
Right, not just another bug. A critical distinction.
Definitely. And don't forget other historical clues. Always ask about exposures. Contact with animals, poultry or turtles might point to salmonella.
Mm.
Recent travel, especially to resource-limited settings. That ramps up the risk for various bacterial and some parasitic infections.
Travel history is huge.
Absolutely. And occupation matters, too. Daycare workers, for example, have higher rates of Shigella, Cryptosporidium, Giardia.
Makes sense.
And always check their medical history. Recent antibiotic use. Think C. diff immediately. Certain meds like PPIs can increase infection risk.
The croton pump inhibitors, yeah.
And underlying conditions matter. Pregnancy increases listeria risk significantly. Cirrhosis. Think Vibrio. Hemochromatosis. Yersinia.
Lots of connections there.
Definitely. Then your physical exam should really focus on two main things. Evaluating their volume status and looking for complications.
If they're dry, are they?
Exactly. Dry mucous membranes, poor skin turgor, postural hypotension, maybe even altered sensorium if it's severe. And the abdominal exam is crucial. Are you feeling distension, rigidity, rebound tenderness? Those could signal an ileus or even peritonitis.
Okay. Let's be really clear, though. General lab tests, like a CBC or BMP, are not routinely warranted for most patients who walk in with acute diarrhea.
Absolutely not. Don't just order them reflexively.
So when are they needed?
They're needed when there's substantial volume depletion. Then a basic metabolic panel, a BMP, can screen for things like hypokalemia or check renal function. A complete blood count, a CBC, might be helpful if you suspect severe disease or complications. Like low platelets could make you worry about HUS. A really high white count, a leukemoid reaction, that might point towards C. diff.
And blood cultures?
Blood cultures are really just for patients with high fevers or those who look systemically ill, septic.
Got it. So for most stable patients, just watching them for a few days without doing stool tests is perfectly reasonable.
Totally reasonable. Expectant management.
You don't need to jump to stool tests for everyone.
Yeah.
But when do you make that call? What are the triggers?
Right. We pursue microbiologic stool testing for acute community-acquired diarrhea when patients present with specific red flag features. These are your main indications. First, severe illness.
Define severe again.
Sure. That's fever of 38.5 degrees Celsius or higher. That's 101.3 Fahrenheit or signs of hypovolemia, having more than 6 unformed stools in 24 hours, or really severe abdominal pain.
Okay, severe illness. What else?
Second, clear signs of inflammatory diarrhea. So visibly bloody diarrhea or having many small volume stools that contain blood and mucus.
Got it. Bloody or mucoid.
Third, high-risk host features. This includes older age, say 70 years or older, having significant comorbidities like cardiac disease, where volume shifts could be dangerous.
Right.
An immunocompromising condition like advanced HIV or being on immunosuppressants, having underlying IBD or being pregnant.
High-risk patient groups. Makes sense.
And finally, we also test if symptoms persist for more than 1 week or if there are public health concerns. Think food handlers, healthcare workers, people in daycare settings.
Okay.
The main reason for testing in these specific scenarios is to identify a bacterial pathogen. Knowing the bug can help predict complications and guide your treatment decisions.
Okay, so you've decided testing is warranted. What are you actually ordering? Stool culture is still a workhorse, right? For Salmonella, Campylobacter, Shigella, maybe E. coli 0157. H7.
It is. But here's a key point for when you're on rounds. If you have a strong clinical suspicion for something less common, maybe Vibrio based on seafood exposure or Aeromonas or Yersinia based on travel,
yeah.
Don't just order a routine stool culture. You always need to call your lab or check their requirements. Ask specifically if they need a special request or different media for that specific bug you're suspecting.
Ah, good tip. Because standard culture might miss it.
It absolutely might. It could be the key to getting the diagnosis.
And what about these newer molecular panels, the PCR tests?
Yeah, we're seeing those used much more now. Multipathogen molecular panels, they're fantastic, honestly, because they can detect lots of things at once. Bacteria, viruses, parasites.
Fast results, too, usually.
Often, yes.
Yeah.
In 2023, something like 78% of bacterial diarrheal infections reported to FoodNet were diagnosed using these panels.
Wow.
But, and this is a big, but you need to exercise careful clinical correlation. Because these assays detect genetic material, DNA or RNA. They don't necessarily tell you if the organism is alive, viable, or actually causing the disease.
So a positive test doesn't automatically mean active infection.
Exactly. It needs to fit the clinical picture. And what's super important from a public health and treatment standpoint, any specimen that's positive for a bacterial pathogen on one of these molecular panels should still be submitted for confirmatory culture.
Why?
For public health tracking, outbreak investigations, and crucially, for getting antibiotic susceptibility testing. The molecular panel won't tell you what drugs will work.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
And another quick on-the-wards tip. A negative stool culture is usually a reliable negative for the common bacterial pathogens like Salmonella, Shigella, Campylobacter.
Why?
Because bacteria are usually excreted continuously in the stool during infection. Unlike parasites, which can be shed intermittently, there's rarely a good reason to repeat a bacterial stool culture if the first one was negative and done properly.
Okay, good to know. Don't keep sending cultures hoping for a different result.
Generally, no. Now, there's additional testing in specific situations. For bloody diarrhea, besides testing for SEC, if you see blood but don't see fecal leukocytes, you might think about amebiasis, especially in travelers, men who have sex with men, or institutionalized folks.
Interesting.
For diarrhea that becomes persistent, lasting more than 14 days, testing for parasitic organisms like Giardia or Cryptosporidium is reasonable. You often need multiple specimens, maybe 3 over consecutive days, because they are shed intermittently.
Right, the ova and parasite exams.
Exactly. And if there's that history of recent antibiotic use or healthcare exposure, high suspicion for C. difficile testing.
Always.
Immunocompromised patients. They're at higher risk for less common things, parasites again, but also viruses like CMV. Sometimes you might even need endoscopy with biopsy to diagnose CMV colitis.
Okay.
And obviously in outbreak settings, you test for whatever pathogen is suspected in that outbreak, norovirus in a cruise ship outbreak, Giardia or crypto in a waterborne one.
Makes sense to target the testing.
Okay, so wrapping up evaluation. If you can't remember everything, remember this. Stool testing is not for every patient with diarrhea.
It's a targeted intervention. Reserve it for those with severe illness, inflammatory signs like blood or mucus, high-risk host features, or persistent symptoms. The goal is predicting complications and guiding specific treatments.
Perfect. Now, let's shift to management. This is huge. Fluid repletion, obviously, but also that really nuanced decision about using antibiotics rationally.
Right. The core of management always starts with general measures, first and foremost. Fluid repletion, getting fluids back in,
yeah,
and maintaining nutrition.
Oh, yeah?
Then, for bothersome symptoms, you can consider some symptomatic pharmacologic therapy.
But the big one is antibiotics.
Yes. And I cannot stress this enough. Antibiotics are not indicated in most cases.
Say it again for the people in the back.
Huh. Right. Because, as we said, most acute diarrhea is viral or self-limiting bacteria. It just gets better on its own. Empiric antibiotics, or even specific ones later, are really reserved for severe disease, clear signs of invasive bacterial infection, or for those specific high-risk patients we talked about.
This is where your clinical judgment really comes into play as a resident.
Absolutely. Mm. Now, the most critical therapy, bar none, is rehydration.
Fluids, fluids, fluids.
And ideally, that's done orally, using oral rehydration solutions, ORS. They contain the right mix of water, salt, and sugar.
Why are they so effective?
It's fascinating physiology. Even in secretory diarrheas where the gut is pumping out water, the intestinal glucose absorption mechanism, which relies on sodium cotransport, usually stays intact.
Ah, the SGLT transporter.
Exactly. So giving glucose and sodium together allows the gut to absorb water along with them. It pulls water back in.
Clever.
It is. And frankly, ORS are grossly underutilized in the US. We tend to jump way too quickly to IV hydration.
It really is true. And it reminds me of a common pitfall, assuming ORS is just for kids. What's one common misconception you wish every resident would unlearn about ORS in adults?
Oh, that's a good one. Maybe that it tastes bad so adults won't drink it. There are better formulations now. Or maybe the biggest one is just not thinking of it first. We're so conditioned to reach for the IV pole. But for mild to moderate dehydration, ORS is just as effective, safer, and cheaper.
Good point. Now, while ORS is preferred, if someone comes in really severely hypovolemic, IV fluids are the way to go initially, right?
Oh, absolutely. If someone's in shock or severely dehydrated, you need initial IV fluid resuscitation to stabilize them quickly. But the goal should always be to switch to ORS as soon as they're repleted enough and can tolerate taking fluids by mouth.
Okay. Let's tackle the big one.
Yeah.
Antibiotics. This decision point often feels like the ultimate high wire act for residents, especially overnight when you don't have test results back yet.
It really does.
So when do we pull the trigger? When do the benefits truly seem to outweigh the risks?
Okay, let's start with when to withhold antibiotics. Generally, you hold off in most cases of acute, non-bloody diarrhea that are not associated with travel.
Why?
Because the potential benefits, like maybe shortening symptoms by a day or so, just don't outweigh the downsides. Downsides like side effects, promoting antibiotic resistance, and the risk of triggering a C. diff infection later.
Makes sense.
And here's that crucial point again. It might feel counterintuitive. For most stable patients, where you suspect a STEC infection, especially if they have bloody diarrhea but no fever, you withhold empiric antibiotics while waiting for stool test results.
Even with bloody diarrhea?
Even with bloody diarrhea. If STEC is suspected and they're stable without high fever, why? Because multiple studies show antibiotics do not reduce STEC symptoms or prevent complications like HUS, and in fact, they might increase the risk of developing HUS.
Wow. Okay, that's a critical harm reduction step then. Withhold antibiotics in suspected STEC.
Exactly. Primum non nocere. First, do no harm.
Okay, so when do we favor giving empiric antibiotic? When do the benefits seem to outweigh those risks?
We do favor empiric treatment when the benefits seem higher. This includes patients with severe illness, remember, fever 38.5 to CZ, hypovolemia, 6 stools day, severe pain.
Okay, the severe group.
Also, patients with clear features of inflammatory diarrhea, the visible blood or mucus, especially with fever.
Got it.
And finally, those high-risk host features we discussed. Age 70, significant cardiac disease, immunocompromise, IBD, pregnancy.
So severe illness, inflammatory signs, or high-risk patient.
Correct. In these situations, the potential benefits of treating a likely bacterial infection generally outweigh the relatively low risk of causing harm if it turns out to be STEC.
Okay, so if you decide, yes, this patient needs empiric antibiotics, what's your go-to choice?
Azithromycin is often preferred now, especially for patients with fever or dysentery, or if you suspect fluoroquinolone resistance is likely like someone with recent travel to Southeast Asia or South Asia.
What's the dosing?
You can give a single 1 gram dose for non-dysentery traveler's diarrhea, or sometimes 500 milligrams once daily for 3 days, especially if dysentery is present.
And fluoroquinolones. Still an option?
They are still options, like ciprofloxacin or levofloxacin. They can be given as a single high dose or daily for maybe 3 to 5 days. The single dose fluoroquinolone regimens can sometimes cause more nausea, though.
Okay. Azithro preferred, especially with travel or dysentery, quinolones are an alternative.
Right. And remember, there are specific circumstances where you tailor empiric treatment even more. Severe diarrhea after recent antibiotics. Cover for C. diff.
Makes sense.
Pregnant woman with fever, systemic illness, and maybe a risky food exposure like unpasteurized cheese, you'd want to cover for listeria.
Good point.
Profuse, watery rice water diarrhea after travel to a cholera endemic area. Cover for Vibrio cholerae.
Right.
And severe illness where you suspect shigellosis, especially in groups known for higher resistance rates like men who have sex with men, recent international travelers, people with HIV. You might even need to consider a carbapenem empirically while waiting for susceptibilities.
Oh, okay, so really tailoring it.
It's all about risk stratification and likely pathogens. Now, for symptomatic therapy, things to make the patient feel better, loperamide or Imodium can be used cautiously.
Cautiously, why?
Use it only if fever is absent or low grade, and crucially, if the stools are not bloody or mucoid.
Okay. Non-inflammatory diarrhea only.
Exactly. The dose is usually 4 milligrams initially, then 2 milligrams after each subsequent loose stool, up to a max of maybe 16 milligrams per day for adults.
But what's the critical caution here?
The big caution is avoid antimotility agents like loperamide in patients who do have dysentery features, fever, bloody stools, mucoid stools, unless you are also treating them with appropriate antibiotics.
Why is that?
There's concern that slowing gut motility in the face of an invasive bacterial infection could prolong the illness, worsen symptoms, or even increase the risk of systemic complications like toxic megacolon, although that's rare.
Okay, so no Imodium for dysentery unless they're also getting antibiotics.
That's the safe approach. Bismuth subsalicylate, Pepto-Bismol, is an acceptable alternative if loperamide is contraindicated. It has some mild antibacterial and anti-inflammatory effects.
Well, less effective.
Generally less effective than loperamide for controlling symptoms, and you have to watch out for salicylate toxicity with high doses, especially in kids or people on other salicylates.
Oh, yeah.
You might feel that urge, you know, to give something to stop the diarrhea right away. Patients often ask for it. But remember, fluids are primary, and if you do use antimotility agents, remember, you might be masking ongoing fluid loss into the gut. That's such a key point.
So you have to be even more aggressive with repletion. Don't let the decreased stool output fool you into thinking they're suddenly okay and fully rehydrated.
Excellent point. Keep pushing those fluids. Regarding diet, adequate nutrition is important. Don't starve them.
What should they eat?
Simple things are best. Boiled starches, potatoes, noodles, rice, cereals with salt, crackers, bananas, soup, boiled vegetables. Avoid high-fat foods, as fat can worsen diarrhea.
And dairy.
Temporarily avoid most dairy products. Milk, cheese. Yogurt is usually okay because the lactose is partially broken down. This is because infectious enteritis often causes a temporary secondary lactose malabsorption.
Got it. Brat diet plus some protein, maybe?
Sort of, yeah. Bland, easy to digest foods.
Okay, one more thing to state really explicitly. What about probiotics? Everyone asks about probiotics.
Yeah, they do. The bottom line for adults is there is currently no proven role for probiotic use in treating acute infectious gastroenteritis. The guidelines are pretty clear on that for adults.
Good to know. Don't waste time or money on them for this.
Right. So let's summarize management. If you can't remember everything, remember this. Rehydration is paramount ORS first, if possible. Withhold antibiotics for most acute, non-bloody cases, and always withhold them for suspected STEC to prevent HUS. Reserve empiric antibiotics for severe illness, inflammatory signs, or high-risk patients. And exercise extreme caution with antimotility agents like loperamide if dysentery is present.
Excellent summary. Finally, let's quickly touch on follow-up and next steps. Do you need to retest stool?
Generally, no. Follow-up stool testing usually isn't necessary, even if the initial test was positive for something. Once the patient is better, they're better.
Any exceptions?
The main exceptions are specific occupational health requirements. Food handlers, sometimes healthcare workers, might need documented negative tests before they can return to work after infections like Salmonella, Shigella, or Stoco.
Okay.
But you need to consult your local public health department for those specific regulations. They vary.
So if the diarrhea gets better quickly, you're usually done. No more workup needed.
Exactly.
But if it doesn't get better, if it becomes persistent,
then you absolutely need to broaden your search.
No.
Look again for treatable pathogens you might have missed, like parasites, or start seriously considering non-infectious causes of diarrhea.
Okay.
So the final takeaway for this section, if you can't remember everything, remember this. Don't routinely retest stool after acute diarrhea unless public health mandates it for work clearance, or if symptoms persist, which signals a deeper, unresolved problem needing further investigation.
Perfect. All right, let's try to put it all together with a case. You're on overnight call. A 68-year-old patient comes in. They've had 2 days of water diarrhea, but now they're reporting 8 unformed stools just in the last 24 hours.
Okay.
On exam, he's hypotensive when he stands up. He has a fever of 38.7 Celsius and complains of some diffuse abdominal cramping.
Yeah.
Oh, and he just got back from a short business trip to Southeast Asia a few days ago, and he mentions taking a PPI for heartburn.
Okay, lots of info there.
Walk us through it. Based on everything we've discussed, what are your immediate concerns here?
All right, immediate concerns are definitely jumping out. First, this sounds like severe illness. Mm-hmm. The high fever, the orthostatic hypotension suggesting hypovolemia, the high frequency of stools, 8 in 24 hours.
Right.
Second, he fits high-risk host features.
Right.
He's 68 years old.
Yep.
Third, the recent travel to Southeast Asia is a huge flag for potentially resistant pathogens or less common infections.
Okay.
And fourth, the PPI use itself is a risk factor for infectious diarrhea. So yeah, this patient screams high risk and potentially serious.
Given all those red flags piling up, what's your absolute first management step before anything else?
Fluids. Aggressive 4D fluid repletion right now, given his orthostasis. Get those fluids in, stabilize his hemodynamics, then absolutely plan to transition him to oral rehydration solutions once he's more stable and can drink. Rehydration is priority number one.
Okay, fluids first. Now, would you order stool testing on this guy? If so, what tests and why?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Given the severe illness, his high-risk status, and the travel history, stool testing is definitely indicated. I'd order a standard stool culture, but also definitely a multiplex molecular panel to cast a wide net.
Okay.
And crucially, given that Southeast Asia travel, I would specifically talk to the lab or make sure the order reflects the need to look for potential fluoroquinolone-resistant pathogens. Maybe even specifically ask about Vibrio testing if the diarrhea was described as particularly profuse or watery, or ensure they'll culture for Shigella and test susceptibilities.
Good point about specifying due to travel. Now, the big question. Would you start empiric antibiotic therapy right away? If yes, which one and why?
Yes, I would start empiric antibiotics here. He clearly meets the criteria. Severe illness, high-risk host. And because of that Southeast Asia travel history, which raises a strong suspicion for fluoroquinolone resistance,
right.
Azithromycin would be my preferred empiric agent.
It makes perfect sense based on our discussion. Okay, now for the twist. His initial stool culture comes back negative for Salmonella, Shigella, and Campylobacter. The multiplex PCR result is still pending. What do you do now? Does the negative culture change anything immediately?
Okay. This is where you need to stay sharp. The negative culture doesn't completely rule out a bacterial cause, especially since the PCR is pending, and culture might miss some things or take longer.
Right.
It definitely doesn't rule out resistant bugs, viruses, or parasites covered by the PCR panel. So my immediate plan wouldn't change drastically based only on the negative initial culture.
So what do you do?
Continue the supportive care. Keep hammering those fluids. Keep him monitored closely. Await that multiplex PCR result, which might give us the answer. If his symptoms persist or worsen despite supportive care and the azithromycin, and the PCR comes back negative for common bacterial and viral pathogens.
Then what?
Then I'd start thinking more broadly again. Could this be a parasite not well covered by the panel? Do we need specific O&P exams? Or is it time to consider non-infectious causes given his age, although the presentation sounds infectious? But the key is, don't stop supportive care, await the better test, PCR, and reevaluate continuously.
Great walkthrough. Really highlights the sequential thinking.
Yeah, you have to adjust as new data comes in.
So before we wrap up, here's a provocative thought for you, the listener, to consider. In this era of increasingly rapid and broad molecular diagnostics, these PCR panels, Are we maybe becoming a bit too reliant on the tests?
Interesting question.
Are we losing some of that crucial art of detailed history taking and physical examination in guiding our initial management of diarrhea before the tests are even back? And how might that reliance potentially impact antibiotic stewardship on your wards?
It's definitely something to think about, balancing technology with fundamental clinical skills.
Absolutely. So that's your challenge for this week. When you encounter a patient with diarrhea on rounds, really dig into that history, the timing, the exposures, the travel, the meds. Assess that volume status carefully. Ask yourself, is this patient truly high risk based on clinical features? Does this presentation truly warrant empiric antibiotics right now? Or is supportive care the right initial path? Apply these decision points we've unpacked today.
Practice makes perfect.
It does. And we want to hear from you. Share your experiences applying these principles. Did anything surprise you? Find us online. Tell us what stood out to you in this deep dive.
We'd love to hear your thoughts.
Until next time on 88 Diagnoses, keep learning, keep questioning, and keep making those informed decisions.